Hi, I'm Talia Massiri, editor at Real Deals, and here is a summary of our recent secondaries roundtable discussion, where I was joined by Graham Thomas, managing partner at Stage Capital, Raj Chail, principal of secondaries investments at Hamilton Lane, Petra Bukovec, partner at Pantheon, Valerie Handel, managing director at Tarbervest, and Ian Visa, origination director for fund solutions at Investec.
Okay, so to begin, clearly all of us have been impacted by the pandemic in some way or other. And this, of course, is no different for secondaries as well. So to start, I'm interested to get views from each of you on the panel first about kind of what was the initial response of secondary players to the pandemic and how have secondary funds performed the last 12 years. So Graham, from a GP's perspective, could you perhaps start us off here?
I personally was quite surprised by how quickly the market, certainly on the GP-led side and the bigger GP-led side, bounced back in the second half of the year. I mean, it was a fairly dramatic bounce back. So, you know, I think the initial was, what does this mean for valuations and when does that settle down? And I think in some instances it settled down pretty quickly, and in others it is still settling down. I think as a general observation, if I look at our portfolio, when we did our Q1 valuations, which were sort of in the heart of the first lockdown, we were pretty cautious about it. And I think in general, in speaking to other GPs and LPs, I think this is generally true. It wasn't as bad as perhaps we had feared.
I'm interested to get the view of the LPs on the panel as well. How did you view the secondaries market since the pandemic hit? And how comfortable were you with allocating capital to secondaries funds? Petra, would you be able to start us off here?
Deal flow has significantly slowed down in Q2, especially on the traditional LP side, given the uncertainties in the market, which has resulted in, you know, buyers being more cautious, but the sellers not adjusting their price expectations yet. On the GP-led market, we didn't see a significant drop. As soon as the summer hit, the GP-led market remained, picked up and has remained extremely active, throughout the second half of 2020.
Valerie and perhaps Roger can follow on. What are your views of the overall kind of response of the secondary market to the pandemic?
I think, one of the characteristics of the secondary market is that you are purchasing assets on valuations that are a quarter to two quarters stale, if you want. And so we all needed to, A, take stock of what was going on in the markets, what the reality of the economy was, but also needed time for the valuations to adjust, to reflect reality on the one hand with the markets dropping, but also very importantly from an operating performance, trying to, peel back the onion to really understand which companies were being affected versus those who were actually benefiting from the pandemic.
You know, there was a slowdown in deal flow during the pandemic and especially during Q2. I think, what we tried to do is really sort of play areas that led recovery, so more around growth and more technology-led type assets. So I think where we spent time was more around that during the sort of latter half of Q2 and Q3. And actually similar to everybody else, overall 2020 was pretty much in line with 2019 in terms of deployment. And actually, I guess, just immediately after the pandemic during Q2, there was a lot of, buzz in the market around preferred equity deals. I think that, that's something that I think a lot of secondary players looked at. I think there's a sort of a question around, how much of that deal flow got done from players who, aren't necessarily totally focused on preferred equity. But
Last but not least on this question, Ian, I know Investec have recently done their secondaries report. So have you got any observations as to how the market responded?
Q2 was really a time for, especially for GPs, to educate themselves as to what liquidity alternatives were available in the market. In fact, I think the number of calls and discussions we had, it was off the charts. In fact, I would go as far as to say bankers, including ourselves, generally phone secondary participants and primary participants, but the tables had turned, we were getting the call. So it was actually quite a nice position to be in.
And now moving slightly on in terms of clearly the industry is young in comparison to other asset classes. And I guess one of the key benchmarks that we like to compare back to in finance quite a lot is the Great Financial Crisis of 2008-2009. Clearly, though, it wasn't a similar recession in terms of the pandemic was a health crisis. The Great Financial Crisis was mostly financially led. But I'm interested to understand how the response of the market this time round can be compared to how the secondary markets responded to the Great Financial Crisis. Raj, do you have any views on this at all?
You know, if you just sort of take a step back and just think about, you know, what happened last time versus this time, you know, the big, I think, difference, and this applies not just to secondaries, but generally across markets, is stimulus. I think, you know, this time there was almost immediate application of stimulus across central banks, et cetera. And that's obviously kept markets buoyed and actually driven a really strong recovery. So I think in terms of what happened this time around versus last time around, the actual deal flow was obviously subdued, but nowhere near for as a long period as it was last time around. So I think, you know, there was sort of a short period, I think everyone sort of echoed this, there's a short period where there was some slowdown activity, but everyone has generally had a very strong 2020. I think last time round, that slowdown was a little bit longer.
Sure.
I think in terms of what the market size is, I mean, the market has grown tremendously in size. I think volume across 2019 and 2020, I think obviously there's a volume sort of step down, but, you know, run rate's probably 90 billion, 80 to 90 or something. And I think this year everyone's expecting maybe close to 100. I've seen figures like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the market last time was, you know, probably 20% of the size of that. And obviously there's been an increase in fundraising across, you know, all secondary or nearly all secondary funds.
And Ian, what are your views? Kind of what was the size of the market then? And how has the market matured, would you say, since the GFC?
I think, firstly, there was no, we didn't see a lot of distressed sales. I think there were a couple, but I think that's the first thing. I think, you know, there were structural changes. Banks needed to effectively, because of regulations, also offload some of their private equity exposure. So I think the dynamics changed, certainly since the GFC and until where it is now. The one thing that I would say, what we saw is where there were a bit more concern is large family offices, potentially, you know, where they had investments in private equity. They were worried about distributions versus calls, and they were looking at, liquidity alternatives to effectively bridge that gap. So I would probably say the likes of Harbourvest, Pantheon, et cetera, you know, no forced sales. They could sit on their hands and look for the right assets to buy, versus more on the private side that don't have the deep pockets. They were certainly a bit more worried.
And Petra, we've touched on it at the beginning, but in terms of pricing of the secondaries market, how has it been impacted by the pandemic? And would you say, can fair value be achieved in this economy at the moment?
Pricing has been impacted, you know, last spring, you know, when the COVID crisis hit, you know, to a certain extent because of the uncertainties. Uncertainty in the market, how the businesses are going to be impacted, you know, what's going to be the extent of the impact. The pricing has improved, you know, in the secondaries mm-hmm. market, as Valerie said, we're pricing based off, you know, two quarter or two quarters old account dates, you know, referencing the NAV. So as those NAVs have been adjusted, you know, the pricing has improved. I think especially the high quality assets or the COVID resilient assets, you know, have continued to price.
And Graham, do you share those thoughts in terms of the pricing of the secondaries market? Have you had to do a lot of reading between the lines, reading between COVID adjusted EBITDAs? What have you seen?
I think it completely depends on the nature of the company. I think for companies that are not affected, it's business as usual. Yeah, you know, the difficulty is for a business, you know, that's in retail, for example, where obviously its EBITDA has fallen off a cliff, but that's also not, in theory, that's not the sustainable EBITDA of the business, assuming things get back to normal. And I guess that's perhaps a big if that none of us really know at this stage, but assume that they do. And I think that does become difficult, but in my experience, what's happening then is deals just aren't happening because the seller, not unreasonably, says, you know what, my business, that isn't the right EBITDA. And the buyer says, well, I don't believe it yet. And so there's an impasse. And so I think in that sort of situation, you might get into a more structured type of solution and, you know, some of the stuff that Ian potentially does and things to come in and help bridge those gaps.
As Graham mentioned, obviously you'll be involved when it comes to pricing in the secondaries market. What have you seen? Do you believe that fair value can be achieved?
I think the question is, what is fair value? And that, you know, that's where the impasse could be, you know, what I believe versus you believe, that could be very interesting. I think maybe just latching on to what Graham says, I think, you know, where you have a situation, we take a situation where, you know, a fund is reasonably mature, it's got this asset, which is potentially underperforming, but the GP knows the asset really well and, you know, theoretically or wants to just hold on to the asset because it's not underperforming, but I just want to make sure that it does achieve what it believes to be fair value. That's exactly where that, you know, a single asset GP led could be play up the GP's, you know, hand in the sense that, you know, making sure that it can continue growing and knowing the asset. And I think that is one theme that I would say is concentration was always associated with increased risk and diversity, in normal statistics, you know, you kind of, the more you have, the more you bring down the risk. I think where the market has changed view is that we'd like to understand assets, be able to, roll up our sleeves and take a view. So more diversity does not always mean better, because I think going to the plaster point, or, you know, when things do come back to normal, you know, and stimulus runs out and, you know, COVID adjustments are no longer there, you know, how's that business really going to look? And, you know, when you have to analyze 40 companies or 100 versus 4, I think you can take a much better view on a more concentrated portfolio.
What would you say has caused the appetite, this increase in appetite for GP leads over the past few years? Raj, perhaps you could start us off on this one.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both sides of the equation. So I think it's demand and also supply. GPs are clearly getting more comfortable with this idea. I mean, you know, as more transactions get executed in the market, I think you see more and more GPs seeing that actually their own LPs will get comfortable if they present something like this solution to them. And you're also seeing, you know, I guess going back a few years, you might have criticize these types of transactions and said, well, actually, you know, these are GPs who are sort of stuck with their assets, but I think now we're seeing much more high quality GPs with high quality assets using these solutions. So I think it's, you know, a now viable route that GPs consider when they come to sell their businesses. The other thing that's interesting is that there's a lot of what I would say sort of traditional M&A bankers who now actually are trying to build their own sort of expertise in doing these types of transactions. So, you know, that's not just because they're reading it in the press, but that's also driven by their own GP clients saying, actually, you know, we want to consider this as an exit route.
And Valerie and Petra, do you agree, kind of what are your views as to what has caused this increase in GP leads?
Absolutely agree that the market is here to stay and to continue to increase. You know, Raj mentioned many of the reasons, from everything from being, you know, more education in the market, where GPs now understand that it is acceptable to their LPs and to the broader community for them to entertain and actually transact in a GP-led, to, you know, people becoming more advisors focusing on it, so educating more people. And okay. Frankly, we're now starting to see GPs who had done one a few years ago, it's worked out well, looking to do sort of, we're seeing repeat sellers, if you want, in the GP-led market, which is a very encouraging sign.
And Ian, Raj kind of hinted towards this growing pressure and demand on the banks when it comes to GP-leds. What would you say, kind of, how has financing solutions around GP-leds evolved and changed? And has this increase in appetite impacted the financing market?
You know, there's a couple of panelists, their firms being, you know, I would call it at the forefront of already exploring, you know, financing solutions. But one thing that I would say as a bit of a theme is we've seen some of the other secondary players and, you know, very well-known, very large players actually stepping in and, you know, realizing that some of their peers are ahead of the curve, looking at their performance metrics and saying, well, what are they doing different that we're doing? And I would say one of the themes in the last couple of months have been, you know, participants that have not normally used a financing solution in GP-leds also stepping or dipping their toes into that part of the market.
And now moving slightly on to looking at preferred equity. So I'm keen to understand kind of what secondaries firms' appetite is like for preferred equity, and perhaps how is this kind of area of the market shifting. Graham, could you start us off on this one?
You know, I think it gets back to what Ian said. It's around what's the rationale for it and how does that compare as a financing need to frankly to your LP's capital? Is it fulfilling something that a gap that is required? And as long as it is and it makes sense from a cost of capital standpoint, then of course there'll be a market for it.
And Raj, what are your views on preferred equity at the moment?
Immediately after the COVID pandemic erupting, I'd say probably Q2, there was a lot of buzz around preferred equity. And I think a lot of, what probably classed as traditional secondary players took a hard look at those opportunities. I would also say that a lot of those deals, you know, coming out of the sort of early parts of the pandemic, they had attractive pricing around them. But I think that quickly contracted, and actually, you know, where the market is now, I think it's sort of back to kind of the sort of, you know, pre-pandemic state, where you've got, you know, the returns from private for preferred equity being distinct from, you know, the secondary private equity returns that, you know, we all try to achieve. And you know, there, to be frank, there are players in the market who have set themselves up and have set their stall to their investors, saying that, you know, we will deliver returns that are, you know, in the sort of preferred equity type range, and that's fine. Sure. And I think what we saw is those players actually being very productive and doing a lot of deals during the early parts of the COVID pandemic.
And now looking at leverage solutions, Valerie and Petra, if you wouldn't mind kind of looking at this one in terms of, are you seeing leverage solutions in the market becoming more mainstream and accepted by LPs? And what are the secondary solutions perhaps the LPs likely to back this year? Petra, if you wouldn't mind starting us on this one.
In my opinion, leverage, you know, both at the SPV level, you know, and on the other side at the fund level facilities, you know, has played an important role in the secondary market for a while now, you know, and has been used, you know, especially the fund level facilities, you know, probably, you know, well, I think in my opinion, quite widely in the market. I wouldn't say that there has been a significant increase, but I wouldn't say that there has been, you know, a significant decrease in the use of leverage in the secondaries market.
Leverage has become, you know, a part of the secondary market. I think what you do find is that different players have different attitudes towards that leverage. And so, mm-hmm. as Ian was mentioning before, you know, there are, you know, there's the LP side of the market where some are much more aggressive than others. And historically, it wasn't, leverage wasn't very present in the more concentrated, the GP-led or the types of transactions. What we have seen is, you know, as the market has evolved, as players have evolved, their attitude towards leverage has shifted over time, and people are becoming more sophisticated mm-hmm. on their, if you want, strategic use of leverage to give them potential edge, you know, to pay that much more, a little bit more to win an auction, or to be more strategic around the you know, their bids, you know, almost excluding an asset by using leverage. I mean, there are many ways you can play with that tool to fine tune your bid. And depending on the players, some have used that more than others.
And that concludes our secondaries roundtable discussion. For more information on this and for the full write-up, keep your eyes peeled on realdeals.eu.com and on our print magazine. Thank you for listening.